This is Audible.
Welcome to New York. Welcome to New York. Welcome to New York. Hachette Audio presents The City We Became, written by N.K. Jemisin, read by Robin Miles. One belongs to New York instantly. One belongs to it as much in 5 minutes as in 5 years. Thomas Wolfe. Prologue. See, what had happened was, I sing the city. Fucking city. I stand on the rooftop of a building I don't live in and spread my arms, tighten my middle, and yell nonsense ululations at the construction site that blocks my view. I'm really singing to the cityscape beyond. This city'll figure it out. It's dawn. The damp of it makes my jeans feel slimy. Maybe that's because they haven't been washed in weeks. Got change for wash and dry. Just not another pair of pants to wear till they're done. Maybe I'll spend it on more pants at the Goodwill down the street instead. But not yet. Not till I've finished going, and listening to the syllable echo back at me from every nearby building face. In my head, there's an orchestra playing Ode to Joy with a Busta Rhymes backbeat. My voice is just tying it all together. Shut your fucking mouth, someone yells. So I take a bow and exit the stage. But with my hand on the knob of the rooftop door, I stop and turn back and frown and listen, 'cause for a moment I hear something both distant and intimate. Singing back at me, basso deep, sort of coy. And from even farther, I hear something else. A dissonant, gathering growl. Or maybe those are the rumblers of police sirens. Nothing I like the sound of either way. I leave. There's a way these things are supposed to work, says Paolo. He's smoking again. Nasty bastard. I've never seen him eat. All he uses his mouth for is smoking, drinking coffee, and talking. Shame. It's a nice mouth otherwise. We're sitting in a cafe. I'm sitting with him because he bought me breakfast. The people in the cafe are eyeballing him because he's something not white by their standards, but they can't tell what. They're eyeballing me because I'm definitely black, and because the holes in my clothes aren't the fashionable kind. I don't stink. But these people can smell anybody without a trust fund from a mile away. Right, I say, biting into the egg sandwich and damn near wetting myself. Actual egg. Swiss cheese. It's so much better than that McDonald's shit. Guy likes hearing himself talk. I like his accent. It's sort of nasal and sibilant. Nothing like a Spanish speaker's. His eyes are huge, and I think, whew, I could get away with so much shit if I had permanent puppy eyes like that. But he seems older than he looks. Way, way older. There's only a tinge of gray at his temples. Nice and distinguished. But he feels like a 100. He's also eyeballing me, and not in the way I'm used to. Are you listening? This is important. Yeah, I say, and take another bite of my sandwich. He sits forward. I didn't believe it either, at first. Hong had to drag me to one of the sewers, down into the reeking dark, and show me the growing roots, the budding teeth. I'd been hearing breathing all my life. I thought everyone could. Have you heard it yet? Heard what? I ask, which is the wrong answer. It isn't that I'm not listening. I just don't give a shit. Listen. I am listening. No, I mean listen, but no to me. He gets up, tosses a 20 onto the table, which isn't necessary because he paid for the sandwich and the coffee at the counter, and this cafe doesn't do table service. Meet me back here on Thursday. I pick up the 20, finger it, pocket it. Would have done him for the sandwich. Well, because I like his eyes, but whatever. You got a place? He blinks, then actually looks annoyed. Listen, he commands again and leaves. I sit there for as long as I can, making the sandwich last, sipping his leftover coffee, savoring the fantasy of being normal. I people watch, judge other patrons' appearances. On the fly, I make up a poem about being a rich white girl who notices a poor black boy in her coffee shop and has an existential crisis. I imagine Paolo being impressed by my sophistication and admiring me, instead of thinking I'm just some dumb street kid who doesn't listen. I visualize myself going back to a nice apartment with a soft bed and a fridge stuffed full of food. Then a cop comes in, fat, florid guy buying hipster Joe for himself and his partner in the car, and his flat eyes skim the shop. I imagine mirrors around my head, a rotating cylinder of them that causes his gaze to bounce away. There's no real power in this. It's just something I do to try to make myself less afraid when the monsters are near. For the first time, though, it sort of works. The cop looks around, but doesn't ping on the lone black face. Lucky, I escape. I paint the city. Back when I was in school, there was an artist who came in on Fridays to give us free lessons in perspective and lighting and other shit that white people go to art school to learn. Except this guy had done that, and he was black. I'd never seen a black artist before. For a minute, I thought I could maybe be one too. I can be, sometimes. Deep in the night, on a rooftop in Chinatown, with a spray can for each hand, and a bucket of drywall paint that somebody left outside after doing up the living room in lilac, I move in scuttling, crab-like swirls. The drywall stuff I can't use too much of. It'll start flaking off after a couple of rains. Spray paint's better for everything. But I like the contrast of the two textures. Liquid black on rough lilac, red edge in the black. I'm painting a hole. It's like a throat that doesn't start with a mouth or end in lungs. A thing that breathes and swallows endlessly, never filling. No one will see it, except people in planes angling toward LaGuardia from the southwest, a few tourists who take helicopter tours, and NYPD aerial surveillance. I don't care what they see. It's not for them. It's real late. I didn't have anywhere to sleep for the night, So this is what I'm doing to stay awake. If it wasn't the end of the month, I'd get on the subway. But the cops who haven't met their quota would fuck with me. Gotta be careful here. There's a lot of dumb fuck Chinese kids west of Christie Street who want to pretend to be a gang protecting their territory, so I keep low. I'm skinny, dark. That helps too. All I want to do is paint, man, because it's in me, and I need to get it out. I need to open up this throat. I need to, yeah. There's a soft, strange sound as I lay down the last streak of black. I pause, look around, confused for a moment, and then the throat sighs behind me. A big, heavy gust of moist air tickles the hairs on my skin. I'm not scared. This is why I did it, though I didn't realize that when I started. Not sure how I know now, but when I turn back, it's still just paint on a rooftop. Paolo wasn't shitting me. Huh. Well, maybe my mama was right, and I ain't never been right in the head. I jump into the air and whoop for joy, and I don't even know why. I spend the next 2 days going all over the city, drawing breathing holes everywhere, till my paint runs out. I'm so tired on the day I meet Paolo again that I stumble and nearly fall through the cafe's plate glass window. He catches my elbow and drags me over to a bench meant for customers. "You're hearing it," he says. He sounds pleased. "I'm hearing coffee," I suggest, not bothering to stifle a yawn. A cop car rolls by. I'm not too tired to imagine myself as nothing, beneath notice, not even worth beating for pleasure. It works again. They roll on. Paolo ignores my suggestion. He sits down beside me, and his gaze goes strange and unfocused for a moment. "Yes, the city is breathing easier. You're doing a good job, even without training." "I try." He looks amused. "I can't tell if you don't believe me or if you just don't care." I shrug. "Well, I believe you." "I also don't care, not much, because I'm hungry." My stomach growls. I've still got that 20 he gave me. But I'll take it to that church plate sale I heard about over on Prospect. Get chicken and rice and greens and cornbread for less than the cost of a free trade small batch roasted latte. He glances down at my stomach when it growls. I pretend to stretch and scratch above my abs, making sure to pull my shirt a little. "The artist guy brought a model for us to draw once and pointed to this little ridge of muscle above the hips called Apollo's belt." Paolo's gaze goes right to it. Come on, fishy. I need somewhere to sleep." Then his eyes narrow and focus on mine again. "I had forgotten. It's been so long. Once, though, I was a boy of the favelas. Not a lot of Mexican food in New York." He blinks and looks amused again. Then he sobers. "The city will die." He doesn't raise his voice, but he doesn't have to. I'm paying attention now. Food, living, these things have meaning to me. "If you do not learn the things I have to teach you, if you do not help, the time will come and you will fail. And this city will join Pompeii and Atlantis and a dozen others whose names no one remembers, even though hundreds of thousands of people die with them. Or perhaps there will be a stillbirth. The shell of this city surviving to possibly grow again in the future. But its vital spark snuffed for now, like New Orleans. But that will still kill you, either way. You are the catalyst, whether of strength or destruction.
He's been talking like this since he showed up. Places that never were, things that can't be, omens, and portents. I figure it's bullshit because he's telling it to me. The kid whose own mama kicked him out and prays for him to die every day and probably hates me. God hates me. And I fucking hate God back. So why would he choose me for anything? But that's really why I start paying attention. Because of God. I don't have to believe in something for it to fuck up my life. Tell me what to do. Paolo nods, looking smug. Thinks he's got my number. Ah, you don't want to die. I stand up, stretch, feel the streets around me grow longer and more pliable in the rising heat of day. Is that really happening, or am I imagining it? Or is it happening and I'm imagining that it's connected to me somehow? Fuck you. That ain't it. Then you don't even care about that? He makes it a question with the tone of his voice. Ain't about being alive. I'll starve to death someday, or freeze some winter night, or catch something that rots me away until the hospitals have to take me, even without money or an address. But I'll sing and paint and dance and fucking cry the city before I'm done. Because it's mine. It's fucking mine. That's why. It's about living. I finish, and then I turn to glare at him. He can kiss my ass if he don't understand. Tell me what to do. Something changes in Paolo's face. He is listening now to me. So he gets to his feet and leads me away for my first real lesson. This is the lesson. Great cities are like any other living things, being born and maturing and wearying and dying in their turn. Duh, right? Everyone who's visited a real city feels that, one way or another. All those rural people who hate cities are afraid of something legit. Cities really are different. They make a weight on the world, a tear in the fabric of reality, like black holes, maybe. Yeah. I go to museums sometimes. They're cool inside, and Neil deGrasse Tyson is hot. As more and more people come in and deposit their strangeness and leave and get replaced by others, the tear widens. Eventually, it gets so deep that it forms a pocket connected only by the thinnest thread of something to... something, whatever cities are made of. But the separation starts a process. And in that pocket, the many parts of the city begin to multiply and differentiate. Its sewers extend into places where there is no need for water. Its slums grow teeth, its art centers claws. Ordinary things within it. Traffic and construction and stuff like that start to have a rhythm like a heartbeat. If you record their sounds and play them back fast, the city quickens. Not all cities make it this far. There used to be a couple of great cities on this continent, but that was before Columbus fucked the Indian shit up, so we had to start over. New Orleans failed, like Paolo said, but it survived, and that's something. It can try again. Mexico City's well on its way. But New York is the first American city to reach this point. The gestation can take 20 years or 200 or 2,000, but eventually the time will come. The cord is cut and the city,
becomes a thing of its own, able to stand on wobbly legs and do, well, whatever the fuck a living thinking entity shaped like a big-ass city wants to do. And just as in any other part of nature, there are things lying in wait for this moment, hoping to chase down the sweet new life and swallow its guts while it screams. That's why Paolo's here to teach me. That's why I can clear the city's breathing and stretch and massage its asphalt limbs. I'm the midwife, see? I run the city. I run it every fucking day. Paolo takes me home. It's just somebody's summer sublet in the Lower East Side, but it feels like a home. I use his shower and eat some of the food in his fridge without asking, just to see what it'll do. He doesn't do shit except smoke a cigarette, I think, to piss me off. I can hear sirens on the streets of the neighborhood. Frequent. Close. I wonder, for some reason, if they're looking for me. I don't say it aloud, but Paolo sees me twitching. He says, "The harbingers of the enemy will hide among the city's parasites. Beware of them." He's always saying cryptic shit like this. Some of it makes sense, like when he speculates that maybe there's a purpose to all of it, some reason for the great cities and the process that makes them. What the enemy has been doing, attacking at the moment of vulnerability, crimes of opportunity, might just be the warm-up for something bigger. But Paolo is full of shit, too. Like when he says, "I should consider meditation to better attune myself to the city's needs." Like, I'ma get through this on white girl yoga. "White girl yoga," Paolo says, nodding. "Indian man yoga, stockbroker racquetball and schoolboy handball, ballet and merengue, union halls and Soho galleries. You will embody a city of millions. You need not be them, but know that they are part of you." Racquetball? Tennis shit ain't no part of me, Chico. "The city chose you out of all. Their lives depend on you. Maybe. But I'm still hungry and tired all the time, scared all the time, never safe. What good does it do to be valuable if nobody values you?" You can tell I don't want to talk anymore. So he gets up and goes to bed. I flop on the couch and I'm dead to the world. Dead. Dreaming. Dead dreaming. Of a dark place beneath heavy cold waves where something stirs with a slithery sound and uncoils and turns toward the mouth of the Hudson, where it empties into the sea. Toward me. And I am too weak, too helpless, too immobilized by fear to do anything, but twitch beneath its predatory gaze. Something comes from far to the south somehow. None of this is quite real. Everything rides along the thin tether that connects the city's reality to that of the world. The effect happens in the world, Paolo has said. The cause centers around me. It moves between me, wherever I am, and the uncurling thing, wherever it is. An immensity protects me just this once, just in this place. Though, from a great distance, I feel others hemming and grumbling and raising themselves to readiness, warning the enemy that it must adhere to the rules of engagement that have always governed this ancient battle. It's not allowed to come at me too soon. My protector in this unreal space of dream is a sprawling jewel with filth-crusted facets, a thing that stinks of dark coffee and the bruised grass of a football pitch and traffic noise and familiar cigarette smoke. Its threat display of saber-shaped girders lasts for only a moment, but that is enough. The uncurling thing flinches back into its cold cave resentfully. But it will be back. That, too, is tradition. I wake with sunlight warming half my face. Just a dream. I stumble into the room where Paolo is sleeping. "São Paulo," I whisper, but he does not wake. I wiggle under his covers. When he wakes, he doesn't reach for me, but he doesn't push me away either. I let him know I'm grateful and give him a reason to let me back in later. The rest will have to wait till I get condoms, and he brushes his ashy-ass mouth. After that, I use his shower again, put on the clothes I washed in his sink, and head out while he's still snoring. Libraries are safe places. They're warm in the winter. Nobody cares if you stay all day as long as you're not eyeballing the kids' corner or trying to hit up porn on the computers. The one at 42nd, the one with the lions, isn't that kind of library. It doesn't lend out books. Still, it has a library safety, so I sit in a corner and read everything within reach. Municipal tax law. Birds of the Hudson Valley. What to expect when you're expecting a city baby. NYC edition. See, Paolo? I told you I was listening. It gets close to noon and I head outside. People cover the steps, laughing, chatting, mugging with selfie sticks. There are cops in body armor over by the subway entrance, showing off their guns to the tourists so they'll feel safe from New York. I get a Polish sausage and eat it at the feet of one of the lions. Fortitude, not patience. I know my strengths. I'm full of meat and relaxed and thinking about stuff that ain't actually important, like how long Paolo will let me stay and whether I can use his address to apply for stuff. So I'm not watching the street until cold prickles skitter over my side. I know what it is before I react, but I'm careless again because I turn to look stupid, stupid. I fucking know better. Cops down in Baltimore broke a man's spine for making eye contact. But as I spot these two on the corner opposite the library steps, short pale man and tall dark woman both in blue like black, I notice something that actually breaks my fear because it's so strange. It's a bright, clear day, not a cloud in the sky. People walking past the cops leave short, stark afternoon shadows barely there at all. But around these two, the shadows pool and curl as if they stand beneath their own private roiling thundercloud. And as I watch, the shorter one begins to stretch, sort of, his shape warping ever so slightly, until one eye is twice the circumference of the other. His right shoulder slowly develops a bulge that suggests a dislocated joint. His companion doesn't seem to notice. Yo, nope. I get up and start picking my way through the crowd on the steps. I'm doing that thing I do, trying to shunt off their gaze. But it feels different this time. Sticky, sorta. Threads of cheap shit gum fucking up my mirrors. I feel them start following me. Something immense and wrong shifting in my direction. Even then, I'm not sure. A lot of real cops drip and pulse sadism in the same way. But I ain't taking chances. My city is helpless. Unborn as yet. And Paolo ain't here to protect me. I gotta look out for self, same as always. I play casual till I reach the corner and book it. Or try. Fucking tourists. They idle along the wrong side of the sidewalk, stopping to look at maps and take pictures of shit nobody else gives a fuck about. I'm so busy cussing them out in my head that I forget they can also be dangerous. Somebody yells and grabs my arm as I Heisman passed, and I hear a man yell out, "He tried to take her purse," as I wrench away. Bitch, I ain't took shit, I think, but it's too late. I see another tourist reaching for a phone to call 911. Every cop in the area will be gunning for every black male aged whatever now. I gotta get out of the area. Grand Central's right there. Sweet subway promise. But I see three cops hanging out in the entrance, so I swerve right to take 41st. The crowds thin out past Lex. But where can I go? I sprint across 3rd despite the traffic. There are enough gaps. But I'm getting tired. Because I'm a scrawny dude who doesn't get enough to eat, not a track star. I keep going, though, even through the burn in my side. I can feel those cops, the harbingers of the enemy not far behind me. The ground shakes with their lumping footfalls. I hear a siren about a block away, closing. Shit, the UN's coming up. I don't need the Secret Service or whatever on me, too. I jag left through an alley and trip over a wooden pallet. Lucky again, a cop car rolls by the alley entrance just as I go down, and they don't see me. Now stay down and try to catch my breath till I hear the car's engine fading into the distance. Then when I think it's safe, I push up. Look back, because the city is squirming around me. The concrete is jittering and heaving. Everything from the bedrock to the rooftop bars is trying its damnedest to tell me to go. Go! Go! Crowding the alley behind me is just shit. I don't have words for it. Too many arms, too many legs, too many eyes. And all of them fixed on me. Somewhere in the mass, I glimpse curls of dark hair and a scalp of pale blonde. And I understand suddenly that this is my two cops. One real monstrosity. The walls of the alley crack as it oozes its way into the narrow space. "Oh, fuck no," I gasp. I claw my way to my feet and haul ass. The patrol car comes around the corner from 2nd Avenue, and I don't see it in time to duck out of sight. The car's loudspeaker blares something unintelligible. Probably, "I'm gonna kill you," and I'm actually amazed. Do they not see the thing behind me? Or do they just not give a shit because they can't shake it down for city revenue? Let them fucking shoot me. Better than whatever that thing will do. I hook left onto 2nd Avenue. The cop car can't come after me against the traffic. But it's not like that'll stop some double cop monster. 45th, 47th, and my legs are molten granite. 50th, and I think I'm gonna die. Heart attack, far too young. Poor kid, should've eaten more organic. Should've taken it easy and not been so angry. The world can't hurt you if you just ignore everything that's wrong with it. Well, not until it kills you anyway. I cross the street and risk a look back and see something roll onto the sidewalk on at least 8 legs, using 3 or 4 arms to push itself off a building as it careens a little before coming straight after me again. It's the mega cop, and it's gaining. Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, please, no. Only one choice. Swing right. 53rd, against traffic, an old folks home, a park, a promenade, fuck those pedestrian bridge, fuck that. I head straight for the 6 lanes of utter batshittery and potholes that is FDR Drive. Do not pass go, do not try to cross on foot unless you want to be smeared halfway to Brooklyn. Beyond it, the East River, if I survive. I'm even freaked out enough to try swimming in that fucking sewage. But I'm probably going to collapse in the 3rd lane and get run over 50 times before anybody thinks to put on brakes. Behind me, the mega cop utters a wet, tumid, like it's clearing its throat for swallowing. I go over the barrier, through the grass into fucking hell. I go one lane, silver car, two lanes, horns, 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 three lanes, semi. What a fucking semi doing on the FDR? Is too tall, you stupid upstate hick. Screaming four lanes, green taxi, screaming smart car, ha ha ha. Cute five lanes, moving truck six lanes. And the blue Lexus actually brushes up against my clothes and it blares past, screaming, screaming, screaming. Screaming, screaming, metal and tires as reality stretches. And nothing stops for the mega cop. It does not belong here. And the FDR is an artery, vital, with the movement of nutrients and strength and attitude and adrenaline. The cars are white blood cells, and the thing is an irritant, an infection, an invader, to whom the city gives no consideration and no quarter. Screaming as the megacop is torn to pieces by the semi and the taxi and the Lexus and even that adorable smart car, which actually swerves a little to run over an extra wiggly piece. I collapse onto a square of grass, breathless, shaking, wheezing, and can only stare as a dozen limbs are crushed, two dozen eyes squashed flat, a mouth that is mostly gums, riven from jaw to palate. The pieces flicker like a monitor with an AV cable short, translucent to solid, and back again. But FDR don't stop for shit except a presidential motorcade or a Knicks game. And this thing sure as hell ain't Carmelo Anthony. Pretty soon, there's nothing left of it but half-real smears on the asphalt. I'm alive. Oh, God. I cry for a little while. Mama's boyfriend ain't here to slap me and say I'm not a man for it. Daddy would have said it was okay. Tears mean you're alive. But Daddy's dead, and I'm alive. With limbs burning and weak, I drag myself up, then fall again. Everything hurts. Is this that heart attack? Oh, I feel sick. Everything is shaking, blurring. Maybe it's a stroke. You don't have to be old for that to happen, do you? I stumble over to a garbage can and think about throwing up into it. There's an old guy lying on the bench. Me, in 20 years, if I make it that far. He opens one eye as I stand there gagging and purses his lips in a judgy way, like he could do better dry heaves in his sleep. He says, "It's time," and rolls over to put his back to me. Time. Suddenly I have to move. Sick or not, exhausted or not, something is pulling me. West, toward the city center. I push away from the can and hug myself as I shiver and stumble toward the pedestrian bridge. As I walk over the lanes I previously ran across, I look down onto flickering fragments of the dead megacop, now ground into the asphalt by 100 car wheels. Some globules of it are still twitching, and I don't like that. Infection. Intrusion. I want it gone. We want it gone. Yes. It's time. I blink, and suddenly I'm in Central Park. How the fuck did I get here? Disoriented, I realize only as I see their black shoes that I'm passing another pair of cops. But these two don't bother me. They should. Skinny kid shivering like he's cold on a June day. Even if all they do is drag me off somewhere to shove a plunger up my ass, they should react to me. Instead, it's like I'm not there. Miracles exist. Ralph Ellison was right. Any NYPD you can walk away from, hallelujah. The lake, Bow Bridge, The place of transition. I stop here, stand here, and I know everything. Everything Paolo's told me is true. Somewhere beyond the city, the enemy is awakening. It sent forth its harbingers, and they've failed. But its taint is in the city now, spreading with every car that passes over, every now microscopic iota of the megacop substance. And this creates a foothold. The enemy uses this anchor to drag itself up from the dark toward the world, toward the warmth and light, toward the defiance that is me, toward the burgeoning wholeness that is my city. This attack is not all of it, of course. What comes is only the smallest fraction of the enemy's old, old evil. But that should be more than enough to slaughter one lowly, worn-out kid who doesn't even have a real city to protect him. Not yet. It's time. In time? We'll see. On 2nd, 6th, and 8th Avenues, my water breaks. Mains, I mean. Water mains. Terrible mess. Gonna fuck up the evening commute. I shut my eyes, and I am seeing what no one else sees. I am feeling the flex and rhythm of reality. The contradictions of possibility. I reach out and grip the railing of the bridge before me and feel the steady, strong pulse that runs through it. You're doing good, baby. Doing great. Something begins to shift. I grow bigger, encompassing. I feel myself upon the firmament, heavy as the foundations of a city. There are others here with me, looming, watching. My ancestors' bones on the Wall Street. My predecessors' blood ground into the benches of Christopher Park. No. New others of my new people. Heavy imprints upon the fabric of time and space. São Paulo squats nearest. Its roots stretching all the way to the bones of dead Machu Picchu. Watching sagely and twitching a little with the memory of its own relatively recent traumatic birth. Paris observes with distant disinterest, mildly offended that any city of our tasteless upstart land has managed this transition. Lagos exults to see a new fellow who knows the hustle, the hype, the fight. And more, many more, all of them watching. Waiting to see if their numbers increase. Or not. If nothing else, they will bear witness that we were great. For one shining moment. We'll make it, I say. Squeezing the railing and feeling the city contract. All over the city, people's ears pop. And they look around in confusion. Just a little more, come on. I'm scared, but there's no rush in this. Lo que pasa, pasa. Damn, now that song is in my head. In me. Like the rest of New York. It's all here, just like Paolo said. There's no gap between me and the city anymore. And as the firmament ripples, slides, tears, the enemy writhes up from the deeps with a reality-bridging roar. But it is too late. The tether is cut and we are here. We become. We stand whole and hale and independent, and our legs don't even wobble. We got this. Don't sleep on a city that never sleeps, son. And don't fucking bring your squamous Eldritch bullshit here. I raise my arms and avenues leap. It's real, but it's not. The ground jolts and people think, huh, Subway's really shaky today.
I brace my feet and they are girders. Anchors, bedrock. The beast of the deep shrieks. And I laugh, giddy with postpartum endorphins.
Bring it.
And when it comes at me, I hip check it with the BQE. Backhand it with the Inwood Hill Park. Drop the South Bronx on it like an elbow. On the evening news that night, 10 construction sites will report wrecking ball collapses. City safety regulations are so lax. Terrible, terrible. The enemy tries some kind of fucked up wiggly shits off tentacles. And I snarl and bite into it. Because New Yorkers eat damn near as much sushi as Tokyo, Mercury, and all. Oh, now you're crying? Now you want to run? Nah, son. You came to the wrong town. I curb stomp it with the full might of Queens, and something inside the beast breaks and bleeds iridescence all over creation. This is a shock, for it has not been truly hurt in centuries. It lashes back in a fury, faster than I can block, and from a place that most of the city cannot see. A skyscraper long tentacle curls out of nowhere to smash into New York Harbor. A scream and fall. I can hear my ribs crack and... no. A major earthquake shakes Brooklyn for the first time in decades. The Williamsburg Bridge twists and snaps apart like kindling. The Manhattan groans and splinters, though thankfully it does not give way. I feel every death as if it is my own. Fucking kill you for that, bitch! I am not thinking. The fury and grief have driven me into a vengeful fugue. The pain is nothing. This ain't my first rodeo. Through the groan of my ribs, I drag myself upright and brace my legs in a pissing off the platform stance. Then I shower the enemy with a 1-2 punch of Long Island radiation and Gowanus toxic waste, which burn it like acid. It screams again in pain and disgust, but fuck you! You don't belong here. This city is mine. Get out. To drive this lesson home, I cut the bitch with LIRR traffic, long, vicious, honking lines. And to stretch out its pain, I salt these wounds with the memory of a bus ride to LaGuardia and back. And just to add insult to injury, I backhand its ass with Hoboken, raining the drunk rage of 10,000 dude bros down on it like the hammer of God. Port Authority makes it honorary, New York motherfucker. You just got jerseyed. The enemy is as quintessential to nature as any city. We cannot be stopped from becoming, and the enemy cannot be made to end. I hurt only a small part of it. But I know damn well I sent that part back broken. Good. Time ever comes for that final confrontation, it'll think twice about taking me on again. Me. Us. Yes. When I relax my hands and open my eyes to see Paolo striding along the bridge toward me with another goddamn cigarette between his lips, I fleetingly see him for what he is again. The sprawling thing from my dream. All sparkling spires and reeking slums and stolen rhythms made over with genteel cruelty. I know that he glimpses what I am, too. All the bright light and bluster of me. Maybe he's always seen it. But there is admiration in his gaze now, and I like it. He comes to help support me with his shoulder, and he says, "Congratulations." And I grin. I live the city. It thrives and it is mine. I am its worthy avatar, and together we will never be afraid. Oh, shit. Something's wrong. Interruption. The avatar collapses, sagging onto the thick old hardwood of the bridge, despite São Paulo's efforts to catch him. And amid its triumph, the newborn city of New York shudders. Paolo, crouched beside the unconscious boy who embodies and speaks for and fights for New York, frowns up at the sky as it flickers.
First, it is the hazy midday blue of northeastern skies in June. Then something dimmer, redder, evocative of sunset. As he watches, eyes narrowed. The trees of Central Park flicker as well, as does the water and the very air. Bright, then shadowed, then bright again. Rippling, then nearly still. Sudden new rippling. Humid with a light breeze, still but with a hint of acrid smoke, back to humid. A moment later, the avatar vanishes from Paolo's hands. This is a variation on something he's seen happen before. And for a moment he grows still with fear, but no, the city has not died, thank God. Paolo can feel the presence and aliveness of the entity around him. But that presence is much, much weaker than it should be. Not a stillbirth, but not a sign of health and ease either. There have been postpartum complications. Paolo pulls out his phone and makes an international call. After one ring, the person he's calling picks up, sighing into the phone.
Exactly what I was afraid of.
Like London, then, says Paolo.
Hard to be sure, but yes, so far like London.
How many do you think the greater metropolitan area crosses three states?
Don't make assumptions, just more, as far as you're concerned. Find one, they'll track down their own. The city is still vulnerable, you realize. That's why it took him away, for safekeeping.
I know. Paolo gets to his feet because a jogging couple is about to pass. A biker follows them, even though the path is supposed to be pedestrians only. Three cars pass on the road nearby, even though that particular section of Central Park is supposed to be pedestrians and bikes only. The city continues to spite itself, despite itself. Paolo finds himself watching for signs of danger in the people around him. Warping flesh, those standing too still or watching too intently. Nothing so far. The enemy was routed, he says into the phone absently. The battle was decisive.
Watch your back anyway.
The voice pauses for a rough smog cough.
The city is alive, so it isn't helpless. It certainly won't help you, but it knows its own. Make them work fast. Never good to have a city stuck halfway like this.
I'll be careful, Paolo says, still scanning his surroundings. I suppose it's good to know you care. The reply is a cynical snort, which nevertheless makes Paolo smile. Any suggestions for where to begin?
Manhattan would seem a good start.
Paolo pinches the bridge of his nose.
That covers a lot of territory.
Then you had best get started, hadn't you?
The connection clicks silent. With an annoyed sigh, Paolo turns to begin his task anew. Chapter 1. Starting with Manhattan and the Battle of FDR Drive. He forgets his own name somewhere in the tunnel to Penn Station. He doesn't notice, at first. Too busy with all the stuff people usually do when they're about to reach their train stop. Cleaning up the pretzel bags and plastic bottles of breakfast, stuffing his loose laptop power cord into a pocket of his messenger bag, making sure he's gotten his suitcase down from the rack, then having a momentary panic attack before remembering that he's only got one suitcase. The other was shipped ahead and will be waiting for him at his apartment up in Inwood, where his roommate already is, having arrived a few weeks before. They're both going to be grad students at a... He's forgotten his school's name. Anyway, orientation is on Thursday, which gives him 5 days to get settled into his new life in New York. He's really going to need those days too, sounds like. As the train slows to a halt, people are murmuring and whispering, peering intently at their phones and tablets with worried looks on their faces. Something about a bridge accident, terrorism just like 9/11. He'll be living and working uptown, so it shouldn't impact him too much, but still, it's maybe not the best time to move here. But when is it ever a good time to make a new life in New York City? He'll cope. He'll more than cope. The train stops, and he's first through the door. He's excited, but trying to play it cool. In the city, he will be completely on his own, free to sink or swim. He has colleagues and family members who think of this as exile, abandonment, although in the flurry of the moment, he cannot remember any of those people's names or faces. But that doesn't matter, because they can't understand. They know him as he was, and maybe who he is now. New York is his future. It's hot on the platform and crowded on the escalator, but he feels fine, which is why it's so weird when he reaches the top of the escalator and suddenly, the instant his foot touches the polished concrete flooring, the whole world inverts. Everything in his vision seems to tilt, and the ugly ceiling fluorescence turns stark, and the floor kind of heaves. It happens fast. The world pulls inside out, and his stomach drops, and his ears fill with a titanic, many-voiced roar. It's a familiar sound, to a degree. Anyone who's been to a stadium during a big game has heard something similar. Madison Square Garden sits on top of Penn Station, so maybe that's it. This sound is bigger, though. Millions of people instead of thousands. And all of those voices doubled back on each other and swelling and shifting into layers beyond sound, into color and shaking and emotion until he claps his hands over his ears and shuts his eyes, but it just keeps coming. But amid all of the cacophony, there is a through line, a repeated motif of sound and word and idea. One voice, screaming fury.
Fuck you! You don't belong here. This city is mine. Get out.
And the young man wonders in confused horror. Me? Am I the one that doesn't belong? There is no answer. And the doubt within him becomes an unignorable backbeat of its own. All at once, the roar is gone. A new roar, closer and echoing and indescribably smaller, has replaced it. Some of it is recorded, blaring from PA speakers overhead.
New Jersey Transit train southbound, stopping at Newark Airport, now boarding on track 5.
The rest is the sound of a gigantic space full of people going about their business. He remembers then, as it resolves around him, Penn Station. He does not remember how he ended up on one knee beneath a train schedule sign with a shaking hand plastered over his face. Wasn't he on an escalator? He also doesn't remember ever before seeing the two people who are crouched in front of him. He frowns at them. Did you just tell me to get out of the city? No. I said, do you want me to call 911? Says the woman. She's offering water. She looks more skeptical than worried, like maybe he's faking whatever weird faint or fit that's apparently made him fall over in the middle of Penn Station. No. He shakes his head, trying to focus. Neither water nor the police will fix weird voices in his head or hallucinations caused by train exhaust or whatever he's experiencing.
What happened?
You just kind of went sideways, says the man, bent over him.
He's a portly, middle-aged, pale-skinned Latino, heavy New York accent,
kindly tone. We caught you and pulled you over here.
Oh.
Everything's still weird. The world isn't spinning anymore, but that terrible layered roar is still in his head. Just muted now, and overlaid by the local and perpetual cacophony that is Penn Station.
I think I'm fine.
Yeah? You don't sound too sure, the man says.
That's because he's not. He shakes his head, then shakes it again when the woman pushes the water bottle forward.
I just had some on the train.
Low blood sugar, maybe? She takes the water bottle away and looks thoughtful. There's a little girl crouched beside her, he notices belatedly, and the two of them are nearly mirrors of each other, both black-haired, freckled, frank-faced Asian people. When was the last time you ate?
Like 20 minutes ago.
He doesn't feel dizzy or weak either. He feels new. He murmurs without thinking, I feel new. The portly man and frank-faced woman look at each other, while the little girl throws him a judgy look, complete with lifted eyebrow.
Are you new here? Asks the portly man.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
My bags!
But they're right there. The good Samaritans have kindly pulled them off the escalator, too, and positioned them nearby out of the flow of traffic. There's a kind of surreality to the moment, as he finally realizes he's having this blackout or delusion or whatever it is in the middle of a crowd of thousands. Nobody seems to notice except these three people. He feels alone in the city. He is seen and cared for in the city. The contrast is going to take some getting used to.
You must have gotten your hands on some of the really good drugs, the woman says. She's grinning, though.
That's okay, isn't it? That's what'll keep her from calling 911. He remembers reading somewhere that New York's got an involuntary commitment law that can hold people for weeks, so it's probably a good idea to reassure his would-be rescuers as to his clarity of mind.
Sorry about this,
he says, pushing to his feet.
Maybe I didn't eat enough or something.
I'll go to an urgent care clinic. Then it happens again. The station lurches beneath his feet, and suddenly, it is in ruins. There's no one around. A cardboard book display in front of the convenience store has fallen over, spilling Stephen King hardcovers everywhere. He hears girders in the surrounding structure groan. Dust and pebbles falling to the floor as something in the ceiling cracks. The fluorescent lights flicker and jerk, one of the overhead fixtures threatening to fall from the ceiling. He inhales to cry a warning. Blink. Everything is fine again. None of the people around him react. He stares at the ceiling for a moment, then back at the man and woman. They're still staring at him. They saw him react to whatever he was seeing. But they did not see the ruined station themselves. The portly guy has a hand on his arm because he apparently swayed a little. Psychotic breaks. Must be hell on inner ear balance.
You want to carry bananas, the portly guy suggests. Potassium. Good for you.
Or at least eat some real food, the woman agrees, nodding. You probably just ate chips, right? I don't like that overpriced crap from the train dining car either, but at least it'll keep you from falling over.
I like the hot dogs, the girl says. They're crap, baby, but I'm glad you like them.
She takes the little girl's hand. We've gotta go. You good?
Yeah, he says. But seriously, thanks for helping me. You hear all kinds of stuff about how rude New Yorkers are, but thanks.
Hey, we're only assholes to people who are assholes first, she says, but she smiles as she says it. Then she and the little girl wander off. The portly man claps him on the shoulder.
Well, you don't look like you're gonna chuck. Want me to get you something to eat or some juice or something? Or a banana?
he adds the latter pointedly. No, thanks. I'm feeling better, really. The portly man looks skeptical, then blinks as something new occurs to him.
It's okay, you know, if you don't got money. I spot you.
Oh. Oh, no, I'm good. He hefts his messenger bag, which he remembers costing almost $1,600.
Portly guy looks at it blankly.
Oops. There's probably sugar in this.
There's a plastic Starbucks tumbler in the bag, sloshing faintly. He drinks from it to reassure portly guy. The coffee is cold and disgusting. He belatedly remembers refilling it sometime yesterday, before he got on the train back home and
that's when he realizes he can't remember where he came from. And he tries, but he still can't remember the school he's here to attend. And this is when it finally hits him that he doesn't know his own name.
As he stands there, floored by this triple epiphany of nothingness, the portly guy is turning up his nose at the tumbler.
Get some real coffee while you're here, he says. From a good Boricua shop, yeah? Get some home food while you're at it. Anyway, what's your name?
He rubs his neck and pretends to have a desperate need to stretch, while quietly panicking, he looks around and tries to think of something.
He can't believe this is happening. Who the hell forgets their own name? All he can come up with as fake names go are generic ones like Bob or Jimmy. He's about to say Jimmy arbitrarily, but then, in his visual flailing, his eyes snag on something.
I'm, Manny, he blurts.
You?
Douglas.
Portly guy has his hands on his hips, obviously considering something. Finally, he pulls out his wallet and hands over a business card. Douglas Acevedo, plumber.
Oh, sorry, I don't have a card. Haven't started my new job yet.
Skay,
Douglas says.
He still looks thoughtful.
Look, a lot of us were new here once. You need anything, you let me know, okay? Seriously, it's fine. Place to crash, real food, a good church. Whatever.
It's unbelievably kind.
Manny doesn't bother to hide his surprise.
Wow, man. You don't know me from Adam. I could be a serial killer or something.
Douglas chuckles.
Yeah? Somehow I'm not figuring you for the violent type. You look...
He falters, and then his expression softens a little.
You look like my son. I'm just doing for you what I'd want somebody doing for him, right?
Somehow, Manny knows. Douglas's son is dead.
Right, Manny says softly. Thanks again.
Está bien, mano. No te preocupes.
He waves off then and heads in the direction of the ACE train. Manny watches him go, pocketing the card and thinking about three things. The first is the belated realization that the guy thought he was Puerto Rican. The second is that he might have to take Douglas up on that offer of a place to crash, especially if he doesn't remember the address of his apartment in the next few minutes. The third thing makes him look up at the arrivals departures board, where he found the word that just became his new name. He didn't tell Douglas the full name, because these days only white women can have given names like that without getting laughed at. But even in modified form, this word, this identity, feels more true than anything else he's ever claimed in his life. It is what he's been, without realizing. It is who he is. It is everything he's ever needed to be. The full word is Manhattan. In the bathroom under the sodium lights, he meets himself for the first time. It's a good face,
He pretends to be extra meticulous about washing his hands. Not a bad thing to be in a smelly Penn Station public bathroom. And turns his face from side to side, checking himself out from all angles. It's clear why the dude figured him for Puerto Rican. His skin is yellowy brown, his hair kinky, but loose coiled enough that if he let it grow out, it might dangle. He could pass for Douglas's son, maybe. He's not Puerto Rican, though. He remembers that much. He's dressed preppy, khakis, a button-down with rolled-up sleeves, and there's a sports jacket draped over his bag for when the AC is too high, maybe since it's summertime and probably 90 degrees outside. He looks like he's somewhere in that ageless yawn between not a kid anymore and 30, though probably toward the latter end of it, to judge by a couple of random gray threads peppered along his hairline. Brown eyes, behind dark brown-rimmed glasses. The glasses make him look professorial. Sharp cheekbones, strong, even features, smile lines developing around his mouth. He's a good-looking guy. Generic all-American boy, non-white version. Nicely nondescript. Convenient, he thinks. Wondering why he thinks this makes him pause in mid-hand wash, frowning. Okay, no, he's got enough weirdness to deal with right now. He grabs his suitcase to leave the bathroom. An older guy at the urinal stares at him all the way out. At the top of the next escalator, this one leading up to 7th Avenue, it happens a third time. This episode is better in some ways and worse in others, because Manny feels the wave of whatever it is coming on as he reaches the top of the escalator. He has enough time to take his suitcase and get himself over to some kind of digital information kiosk so he'll be out of the way while he leans against it and shudders. This time, he doesn't hallucinate, not at first, but he hurts all of a sudden. It's an awful, sick feeling. A spreading chill, starting from a low point on his left flank. The sensation is familiar. He remembers it from the last time he got stabbed. Wait, he got stabbed? Frantically, he pulls up his shirt tail and looks at the place where the pain is worst, but there's no blood. There's nothing. The wound is all in his head, or someplace else. As if this is a summons. Abruptly, the New York that everyone sees flickers into the New York that only he can see. Actually, they're both present, one lightly superpositioned over the other, and they flick back and forth a little before finally settling into a peculiar dual boot of reality. Before Manny lie two 7th Avenues. They're easy to distinguish because they have different palettes and moods. In one, there are hundreds of people within view and dozens of cars and at least six chain stores that he recognizes. Normal New York. In the other, there are no people. And some unfathomable disaster has taken place. He doesn't see bodies or anything ominous. There's just no one around. It's not clear anyone ever existed in this place. Maybe the buildings here just appeared, sprung forth fully formed from their foundations, instead of being built. Ditto the streets, which are empty and badly cracked. A traffic light dangles loose from an overhead fixture, swinging on its cable, but switching from red to green in perfect tandem with its other version. The sky is dimmer, almost as if it's nearly sunset and not just post-noon. And the wind is faster. Clouds boil and churn across the sky like they're late for the cloud revival meeting. Cool, Manny murmurs. This whole episode probably represents some kind of psychotic break on his part. But he cannot deny what he sees is gorgeous and terrifying. Weird, New York. He likes it, regardless. But something is wrong with it. He must go somewhere, do something, or all of the bifurcated beauty that he sees will die. He knows this suddenly, more surely than instinct. I have to go, he murmurs to himself in surprise. His voice sounds strange, tinny and sort of stretched out. Maybe he's slurring. Maybe it's the peculiar echo of his voice from the walls of two different Penn Station entryway walls in two different Penn Stations. Hey, says a guy in a neon green button down nearby. Manny blinks at him. Normal New York abruptly resumes, weird New York vanishing for the moment. It's still somewhere nearby, though. The button down is part of a uniform. The guy's carrying a sign hawking bike rentals at tourists. He faces Manny with open hostility. Puke your drunk ass off somewhere else! Manny tries to straighten, but he knows he's still a little diagonal. I'm not drunk. He's just seeing juxtaposed multiple realities while being plagued by inexplicable compulsions and phantom sensations. Well then, take your high ass somewhere else. Yes, that's a good idea. He needs to go east. He turns in that direction, following instincts he never had before a few minutes ago. What's that way? He asks Bike Guy. My left nut, Bike Guy says. That's south, laughs another bike rental hawker nearby. Bike Guy rolls his eyes and grabs his crotch at her in the iconic New York Sign Language gesture of suck my dick. The attitude's starting to grate. Manny says, if I rent a bike, will you tell me what's in that direction? Bike Guy suddenly all smiles. Sure. No, sir, says Bike Woman, serious now, as she comes over. Sir, I'm sorry, but we cannot rent a bike to someone who appears to be intoxicated or ill. Company policy. Do you need me to call 911? People in New York sure like to call 911. No, I can walk. I need to get to FDR Drive. FDR Drive. The woman's expression turns skeptical. You want to walk to FDR Drive? What the hell kind of tourist are you? Sir, he ain't no tourist, says he of the southern left nut, as he chin points at Manny. Look at him. Manny's never been to New York before, at least as far as he knows. I just need to get there, fast. Take a cab, then, says the woman. Taxi stands right there. Need me to grab one for you? Manny shivers a little, feeling the rise of something new within himself. Not sickness this time, or rather, not just sickness, since that terrible, stabbish ache hasn't faded. What comes instead is a shift in perception. Beneath his hand, which rests on the kiosk, he hears a soft rattle of decades worth of flyers. The kiosk has nothing on it. There's no sign, do not post bills. He hears what used to be there. Traffic's flying past on 7th. Hurrying to get through the light before a million pedestrians start trying to get to Macy's or K-Town Karaoke and Barbecue. All these things belong. They are rightness. But his eyes stutter over a TGI Fridays, and he twitches a little, lip curling in involuntary distaste. Something about its facade feels foreign, intrusive, jarring. A tiny, cluttered shoe repair shop next to it does not elicit the same feeling. Nor does a vape shop next door. Just the chain stores that Manny sees, a Foot Locker, a Sparrow, all the sorts of stores one normally finds at a low-end suburban mall. Except these mall stores are here, in the heart of Manhattan, and their presence is not truly harmful, but irritating. Like paper cuts or little quick slaps to the face. The subway sign, though, feels right and real. The billboards, too, no matter what's on them. The cabs and flow of cars and people, all these things soothe the irritants somehow. He draws in a deep breath, that reeks of hot garbage and acrid steam belching from a manhole cover nearby. And it's foul, but it's right. More than right. Suddenly he's better. The sick feeling recedes a little, and his side dulls from stabbing pain into cold prickles that only hurt when he moves. Thanks, he says to bike woman, straightening and grabbing his roller bag. But my ride's coming. Wait, how does he know that? The woman shrugs. Both of them turn away to resume hawking bikes. Manny walks toward the area where people are waiting for Lyfts or Ubers. He has both apps on his phone, but he hasn't used them. There should be nothing here for him. However, a moment later, a cab rolls to a stop right in front of him. It's like a cab out of an old movie, smooth and bulbous and huge, with a black and white checkered stripe along its near flank. Bike guy does a double take, then whistles, a checker. Haven't seen one of those since I was a kid. It's for me, Manny says unnecessarily and reaches for the door. It's locked. I need this open.